Bobbish.
So it's my pleasure to give this talk to you today about two different projects that we've been doing at my group at MPI for Software Systems over the past 10 years. One of those is Rust Belt, which is in the title of the talk, which is a project about developing the first formal foundations for the Rust programming language. And the other one is Iris, which I'll tell you more about later in the talk, but it's basically been a key enabler for us to be able to do Rust Belt at all. And as Mike said already, I'm going to be having a little audience interaction. Usually when I do this in this talk live, I actually have a bit more audience interaction, but given the technical difficulties, I think I'll ask a couple key questions from the audience at a few parts, and I'd love your participation. So let's get started. So as I said, Rust Belt is all about building foundations for the Rust programming language. What is Rust all about? So Rust is basically tackling a long-standing problem in the design of programming languages, which is that many core systems programming applications, I'm thinking of things like operating system kernels, device drivers, web browsers, game engines, they require low-level control over resources such as the layout of data and memory, pointer manipulation, these kind of things. And so as a result, these applications are typically written in C or C++. Or large components of them are written in C or C++. And as we all know, C and C++ give you that low-level control, but at the expense of safety, right? These languages are patently unsafe, and you can shoot yourself in the foot in many different ways. Now, this is not news, okay? I'm sure you all know this, but it's become increasingly understood in industry that this is a real problem. And in fact, in the past couple of years, major software vendors like Google and Microsoft have come out with this remarkably consistent number of 70%. 70% of the security vulnerabilities that they find in their code bases are due to memory safety problems. Okay, and in particular, things like mistakes with pointers in the C or C++ languages, right, are the key culprit. So again, not a surprise, but it is somewhat surprising to me that there's such a consistent statistic. And so these are exactly the kind of problems that would be avoided if you were to work in a safer, higher level language. But of course, there's a trade-off there, which is that the most existing safe high-level languages don't let you have that low-level control that this class of applications requires. And so the obvious sort of direction to look in is what you see in the title of this blog post down here, which is that what we need is a safer low-level systems programming language. And that's exactly what Rust is trying to provide. So Rust has been in development for a bit over 10 years. It had its 1.0 release in 2015, and it was developed originally at Mozilla and used to build Servo, which is the next generation web browser engine, pieces of which have been incorporated into Firefox. But Mozilla is not the only company, of course, that's using Rust. It's rapidly gained traction throughout the industry, and there are now many major companies using Rust in production. The Rust Foundation was formed just last year, so the support for the further development of Rust has been spread across a number of the major funding has been spread across a number of major companies. The reason that so many people are really interested in Rust is that it's really the only systems programming language that's been developed so far that provides three things: one, low-level control in the style of modern C++, two, strong safety guarantees like type safety and memory safety, but also guarantees like data race freedom, which are not guarantees you typically even get from most safe high-level languages. And thirdly, and last but not least, is the industrial development and backing of these many software vendors. So I think it's safe to say Rust has become a big thing already. But the reason it's become so big is precisely these safety guarantees, or these claimed safety guarantees, which are really central to the promise of the language and differentiate it from languages like C and C++. So this, of course, leads to the question: how do you know Rust is actually safe? So before I can get into more details about why that's an interesting question, why it's challenging, I need to tell you a bit more about Rust. I imagine some of you are familiar with Rust, so part of this beginning of the talk will be review for you, but I think it'll still be useful. So the core idea of Rust is basically that the root of all evil in systems programming is the unrestricted combination of mutation and aliasing. Okay. In other words, for example, if you have some object in memory, you have multiple references or aliases to that object, and one of those aliases is used to potentially deallocate and reallocate the object somewhere else, that can corrupt the views of the other references. And this leads to phenomena like dangling pointers, use after free errors, data races, iterator invalidation, all these kind of classic anomalies that you find in C and C++ programs that cause all manner of security vulnerabilities. And so the idea of Rust is basically to prevent all of these errors statically using a sophisticated type system known as an ownership type system, which effectively prevents this unrestricted combination of mutation and aliasing, thereby getting rid of these phenomena. So the basic idea, the very basic, sort of one slide story about Rust is that it's all based on ownership. So the idea is that unlike in a typical programming language where you just have values and you can copy the values wherever you want, at least for functional programming, here, if you have a value of type T in Rust, then it actually denotes something more. It denotes ownership of that value. Okay, and that tells you that you not only have access to the value, but you are the only, or your piece of code that can refer to that value is the only piece of the program that can refer to it, can refer to the resources that back up that value. For example, the layout of that object in memory. And you know that no other part of the program can access it at the same time. Now, a very strict ownership discipline like that is pretty restrictive. And so, you want to be able to support things like passing values by reference to other parts of the program or sharing values between threads in a concurrent setting. And so so this leads to the idea of borrowing. So a value can be borrowed, and there's two different ways of borrowing it, each of which sort of points to a different trade-off in this mutation versus aliasing question. So one way of borrowing is called a shared or immutable borrow. And those borrows can be copied freely. You can make as many aliases you can make any copies of the references you want, but you can't mutate through them. The other one is called a unique or mutable borrow. And those, as the name suggests, right, you can mutate through the reference, but you know that you're the only one who's currently allowed to do so. And so so with these basic mechanisms, these are sort of the key basic mechanisms that enable Rust to work. So I'm gonna now go quickly to a very, somewhat pathetic demo that is just it's really sort of a Rust 101 demo. So it's not interesting from a research point of view, but it's just to give you an idea of like what's going on with this ownership and borrowing. So we have here a very simple program. We create a vector v, which stores 1, 2, and 3, and then we push 42 onto the end of the vector, and then we iterate through the vector. This for I in ampersand v implicitly is creating an iterator over the vector, okay? And then we print the elements of the vector. So, you can predict that when you run this, it's going to have the expected effect of, it's going to compile correctly, and it's going to print 1, 2, 3, 42, okay? I think this shouldn't be too surprising. So now what happens, okay, if we move that call to the push inside the loop, okay? So the question, and now here's my first question for the audience, see if you're paying attention, is, what do you expect to happen? What do you expect will happen when we try to compile this? And is this a, is there something wrong with this program or something bad about this program? So I leave this question to you before I show you what Rust actually does.
So still, again, there's a little delay here. Otherwise, I'll ask a question here. See how that goes.
It's up to you, Mike, to tell me what the answer is. You could be my prime audience member.
Well, see, I'm not seeing anything yet, but I'll see that yet. But it worries me, even if this weren't in Rust, right? It worries me because you're iterating over something that is growing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so why is that a problem?
You might iterate infinitely or not, depending on whether that V refers to the one that has 1, 2, 3 in it, or if it gets updated to the changing 40,
another 40. That is certainly a correct, that would be a sort of correctness problem. But is there even the safety problem here?
It depends on how that iteration is implemented, right?
Yeah.
So
it also depends on how the vector is implemented.
So if there's if the vector is updated to some other, if the vector is updated to point to another memory structure because it's, I don't know, copying the array, I guess the iterator might not have noticed that move.
Yes, exactly. Right. So that's exactly right. So okay, I'll take that answer on behalf of the audience. and keep going. So so indeed, I'll run this. So okay, so yeah, Rust rejects this. I'll explain what Rust is saying here in a second. So first of all, this is bad because vector is, I mean, you may or may not know, vector is implemented using sort of a statically allocated, or not statically allocated, but a buffer. Okay, it has some internal buffer. And once you push enough elements onto the buffer that fill up that available space, then it deallocates that space, copies it to a new larger buffer, and goes from there. So basically, if the push of 42 at some point has that effect of running out of the space of the vector and it copies the buffer over somewhere else, then the iterator here is going to be referring to, it's going to be a dangling pointer, basically. It's going to be referring to the old smaller version of the buffer. This is in addition to the comment you made, of course, about this could go on infinitely. But this is generally a phenomenon known as iterator invalidation. That is a very common problem in C++ programs. So here what Rust does is it says, no, you can't do this because, okay, and this is the error, it says, cannot borrow V as mutable because it is already also borrowed as immutable. And it tells you exactly here that this, that when we created the iterator, we implicitly were create, well, actually it's not even implicit, we write ampersand V here. We create a shared or immutable borrow of the vector in order to iterate over it. And then when you call v.push of 42 over here, you're implicitly, there's a that method call is going to create a mutable borrow because the push method of vec requires a mutable reference to the vector because it's going to mutate it. And so you're not allowed to do a mutable borrow while there's an outstanding immutable borrow. Okay, that's just violating the basic principle of mutation and aliasing in Rust. So this gives you a simple example of how this borrowing is very useful. And just to point out, we can, you know, it's not, it, once you've borrowed something as immutable, it doesn't mean that you can never mutate it again. After the for loop, for example, we could put a push of 42, and that's perfectly fine because after the for loop, the shared borrow of the vector that was required for the iteration is over, and now we're just, and now we get back full ownership of the vector, and we can do whatever we want with it. Okay, and in this case, it just prints 1, 2, 3. Okay. There's a lot of stuff going on in Rust that to make this work, a lot of stuff which I'm not going to talk about in detail today, actually, but tracking the scopes of these borrows and making sure that that you never have, for example, mutable and immutable borrows of an object at the same time. So that was just a quick demo to give you an idea of how this, you know, this plays out in Rust and how Rust avoids these kind of anomalies. So all right, so that's all the good news. Okay, this very nice core idea, and this is what you hear about when you hear about Rust typically. So the problem is that's not the whole story. Okay, so sometimes you actually do need to mutate alias state. Like, there's no way around it for certain kinds of abstractions, for implementing certain kinds of abstractions or data structures. For example, there are, you know, a number of pointer-based data structures that fundamentally require mutation and aliasing to implement them at all. For example, a doubly linked list where you have, you know, multiple aliases to individual nodes, but you still want to be able to mutate the list. Synchronization mechanisms like locks, channels, semaphores, right? These fundamentally, at some level, you need to implement them using some kind of shared state to implement the communication between threads. Memory management, things like reference counting, you have multiple clones of some reference counted object, or they're all pointers to the same object, but you each one when you clone or deallocate the reference will update this shared reference count. So these are all examples where, like, under the hood, you need some alias mutable state. And so what do you do? Well, the Rust story about what you do is basically that you provide these abstractions with libraries, okay? So, or APIs. So I'll give you a simple example of this that I'm going to use as actually it's two APIs that I'm going to use as a running example throughout this talk. And the first one is, here's the example, right? So we have an object X that we want to share mutable access to this X between multiple threads. And one way of doing this, there's a number of ways, would be to wrap it in an arc of a mutex. Okay, so the mutex API is a wrapper that allows you to synchronize access to X by requiring anyone who wants to use the mutex to first acquire a lock. Okay, and we know that locks provide that synchronization. The arc is then what allows you to share that mutex dynamically, make as many, you know, copies of that reference to the mutex to share them between multiple threads. Okay, and you track the sharing dynamically using reference countings because Rust is not a garbage collector language. So just to see how this would play out, we could create, for example, 10 threads. Each one of them, in each case, we make a clone of this arc, which is just basically has the effect of bumping up the reference count, but you're still referring to the same pointer. Then you spawn a thread. We're going to spawn 10 threads. And in each thread, what we do is we call the lock method of the mutex API to acquire effectively a mutable reference to the underlying object of type T. And then in the scope of that lock acquisition, you can then mutate through Y. Okay. So in this way, you can see that, you know, what we're doing with using these APIs, we can implement shared mutable state, even though Rust seems to be prohibiting shared mutable state. So that means these libraries like Arc and Mutex fundamentally extend the expressive power of the language. How do they do that, of course, right? So what's the consequence of that? Well, it has to do with unsafe code. So the reality of Rust is that most code is written in the safe fragment of the language. And that means it's written according to the restrictions of the type system as I've described so far. But then there's all these APIs like Arc and Mutex and many others, which provide safe abstractions, but internally, because those things could not be implemented with the restrictions of the type system, because they need shared mutable state, they use unsafe features of the language. These are things like raw pointer manipulations, where the memory, where the aliasing is not tracked statically by the type system. And they fundamentally need this in order to extend the expressive power of the language. So the claim that Rust developers, the API developers want to make is that even though these APIs are implemented using unsafe operations, they nevertheless constitute a safe extension to Rust. And that's sort of that's the way that that Rust developers think about these abstractions. But of course, when a sort of formal methods or a verification PL person comes and looks at this, we get very excited because that means lots of opportunities for bugs. Okay, and in fact, over the years there have been a number of bugs found in the type system of Rust and in APIs, and even sometimes in interaction of different APIs that use unsafe code, where one API may be perfectly safe by itself, but not when used in conjunction with other APIs. So there's lots of opportunities for unsafety to be introduced in the language in this way. And so the question is, can we make some sense of what the Rust developers are doing? And so that's been the goal of the Rust Bell project, was to develop the first formal foundations for Rust, to use these foundations to verify the safety of not only the Rust core type system, but also these standard APIs, or a number of standard APIs that use unsafe code in their implementation, and to prove that those are a safe extension of the language. And moreover, to give Rust developers ultimately the tools that they will need in order to be able to be confident that they're safely evolving the Rust language. So let me now get into a bit more about what is challenging about that and how we do it. So So the key challenge really is that the standard approach that people have taken in the programming language community for verifying safety of languages is the so-called syntactic safety approach that was developed originally by Wright and Feleisen in 1994. And this is, this has become known as progress in preservation. And so I think this is, we teach this to a lot of our students. It's a very, very common approach. The problem with this approach, first of all, so just to say at a very high level what the approach is, you adapt the notion of syntactic typing that we have from our programming language to a notion of typing over machine states. And then you show that the program preserves the well-typedness of the machine state is preserved as the program executes. And as long as you're in a well-typed machine state, the program will never have undefined behavior. So the problem is, this only works if your programs are syntactically well-typed. And in essence, once you have unsafe code in your language, they're not really, you've lost syntactic typing, right? You have parts of the program that are not, that are, even if they're safe for some reason, they're not safe for any reason that the syntactic type checker understands. And that's why you have to mark them explicitly in these unsafe code blocks. So basically this whole syntactic safety approach doesn't really work for Rust. And so the approach that we've taken in Rust Belt is to generalize to a notion of semantic safety. And basically an API, you can think of it as, at a very high level, an API is semantically safe if, even though it may use some syntactically or potentially unsafe features inside the implementation, there's no way that a well-typed client of this API can ever encounter unsafe behavior. Okay, so that's a very high-level sort of idea of what semantic safety is. The way we actually prove this is roughly as follows. So the first thing is we have to define something called a semantic model, which is basically interpreting the types of the language and, you know, by generalization, the APIs, right, interfaces, into some safety contracts, okay, which are basically verification conditions in some logic that the implementation of the API has to satisfy in order to be considered semantically safe, in other words, safely linkable with other well-typed Rust code, okay? And so the point is this safety contract is a more general, a more liberal condition than just saying, you know, that the implementation of the API is follows some set of typing rules. It's some more general condition. Okay, and so this is the basic idea of the semantic model. And then once we've developed the semantic model, we prove two things. The first one is that if your code, if the implementation of your API is syntactically safe, meaning it's restricted to the safe fragment of Rust, it adheres to that aliasing and mutation restriction, then it will be proven to satisfy its corresponding safety contract by construction. Okay, so you don't have to worry about code that is syntactically safe. And we prove that as a meta theorem once and for all. If your implementation of your API does use unsafe features, then you have to prove something. You know, you have to prove that it satisfies its safety contract. So there's a manual proof burden there, which we could hope to automate in the future. But the point is there's a proof obligation. But at least we have a proof obligation. At least we know what it is we have to prove in order to say that this API's implementation is actually safe. So looking back at this big picture of sort of the Rust ecosystem, right, there's all this code in the middle. That code is safe by construction. Then for all these APIs that use unsafe features in their implementation, those have to be manually verified against the safety contract corresponding to their interface. But once we've done that verification, we know that any program that uses these APIs and is otherwise syntactically, you know, safe is in fact a safe program. So this is a big win. You know, there's still some manual verification burden here, but it's a big win over something like C++, where you wouldn't have that big blue box in the center, right? You'd have to manually verify everything because you don't get any safety guarantees from the type system. So basically, this has been the idea of the Rust Belt project from the beginning, was to apply this semantic safety paradigm to Rust, and we've done this over the course of several papers. In this talk, I'm going to sort of more general audience talk. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about exactly how we model the Rust type system. This takes, you know, too much time. So what instead I'm going to do is focus on what I think is the most interesting problem about developing Rust Belt, which is figuring out what logic to use. Okay, and this might, you know, you might think, well, you know, I'll just use logic. Like, why do we need to use some special logic? And the answer is basically, if you try to use some standard logic, you know, I don't know, first order logic or higher order logic, you would quickly run into major scalability problems, because it's not even clear how you would even define this model of Rust in such a logic. And it's actually, what you really want is a logic that provides higher level abstractions that are closer to the ideas, the concepts in the Rust type system. So here's one question for the audience, I guess, quick question, is does anyone have any ideas about what general, like very generally, what kind of logic we might want to use in verifying, in modeling, providing our semantic model of Rust types?
Yeah, I have no idea. So I'm hoping for the audience to contribute something.
If no one knows, it's.
I see some experts here in the audience that could, yeah, they should, that could have an idea here. Yeah.
Just curious if anyone has any.
So again, if you have any idea what logics to use, then you could send a direct message to me in Gather.
Yeah.
and then we could go from here. Peter T. Munn to the rescue. Separation logic.
Yeah, he knows too much. Anyway, all right.
Temporal logic has often been suggested.
That's what I was looking for. Separation logic was what I had in mind. So separation logic, for those of you who don't know, which could be, I expect many of you, this is an extension of Hoare logic that was developed about 20, 25 years ago, originally by Peter O'Hearn, John Reynolds, Hong Suk Yang, and their collaborators. And it was developed for reasoning. Initially, it was the idea was to take Hoare logic and make it applicable to reasoning by pointer manipulating programs. But it quickly became clear that actually this logic had much more power than that. Although pointer manipulating programs are still sort of some of the bread and butter of separation logic, and it's been a major influence on many verification analysis tools over the years. And the reason it's such a good fit for Rust is that separation logic is really ownership logic. It's a variant of Hoare logic where you take the idea of ownership as a primitive notion, and all the assertions of the logic are really have the ability to talk about ownership of resources. And so it's therefore a perfect fit for modeling Rust's ownership types, because in Rust the types now give you this built-in concept of ownership. So there's a couple of problems here. One of them is you can't just sort of take separation logic and say, yeah, we'll build a model in separation logic, because there are many separation logics that were developed over the years. The obvious starting point would be something like concurrent separation logic, which was developed in the mid-2000s by O'Hearn and Brooks, and has been extremely influential. There's been a huge amount of work. I'll actually say a bit more about that later. The trouble is, that's not the only one. And there's actually, there was a very nice paper by Matt Parkinson, about 2010, called The Next 700 Separation Logics, where he made this astute observation. He said, in recent years, separation logic has brought great advances in the world of verification. However, there's a disturbing trend for each new library or concurrency primitive to require a new separation logic. So you'd have, a paper coming out every year on some new separation logic that was saying, oh, well, all the previous ones couldn't handle this example. And, now we have a new one which can handle this example. And this is a real, on the one hand, this was nice. There was a lot of development of the field. But the other problem was that this wouldn't work for modeling something like Rust, because you don't want to build a semantic model of Rust in some separation logic and then and you verify some APIs in that logic. And then you discover tomorrow that this logic is not general enough to verify the safety of some new API that you developed. Right? You want some logic that is powerful enough to encompass many different forms of reasoning that are appropriate for reasoning about different APIs. So that was the first problem. Another problem, which I'm not going to talk about really much more in this talk at all, but I just want to mention because it was a big part of the project, was making the memory model that these separation logics depend on more realistic. So all the existing logics before the work we started basically were assuming sequential consistency for memory accesses, which is a very common simplifying assumption about a model of concurrency where threads take turns interacting with some global shared state. But that's not really realistic for high performance concurrency, which is where often these APIs are designed for. In fact, Rust libraries use weaker, relaxed memory operations, basically inherited from C++. And so you need, if you want to have a real model of Rust that models these things properly, then you need to account for weak memory models. So this led to a large body of work that we and collaborators have developed over the years. On several projects. So the first one is IRIS, which is what I'm going to talk about in the rest of this talk, basically, which is a framework for higher order concurrent separation logic that's sort of has the effect of simplifying and consolidating the field of modern separation logic. We also had a line of work on something called GPS, which was the first modern separation logic for the C++ memory model, and which is also applies to Rust. And we've used a combination of both of these things. In fact, we ended up showing that this separation logic, this GPS work, could be encoded in IRIS, which is yet another testament to the generality of the IRIS framework. And we use that to build a model of Rust. So in the rest of the talk, all this was implemented in the Coq Proof Assistant. All the work we've done is on machine check verification. And in fact, I can talk more about that at the end of the talk if people are interested, but that's been a real key enabler for this whole body of work. So the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on IRIS. I'm going to tell you about, more about IRIS and how how the ideas of Iris make it possible for us to build models of Rust types and explain the safety of APIs like Mutex and Rust APIs that I talked about earlier. Let me just check the time. Okay, good. So basically, the rest of the talk is going to split into two parts. One, I'm going to talk about concurrent separation logic, which is this foundation of everything we've been doing. And then I'll talk about Iris and how that extends and generalizes and consolidates the field of concurrent separation logics, which have been built upon on the original CS Hub. Okay, so let's get started. As I said, separation logic is a Hoare logic. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I just wanted to sort of remind you what a Hoare logic looks like. It's a compositional method for verifying programs that are state manipulating programs. So you have some code you're verifying, C. You have some precondition, which is an assertion about the state of the program before C executes, and you have a postcondition, which is an assertion about the state of the program after C executes. And here we're going to be dealing with partial correctness. So we're always this statement PCQ is going to insist that C is safe to execute whenever the precondition holds. And if it terminates, then the postcondition holds of the final state. Okay, that was my very detailed introduction to Hoare logic. You'll see examples of Hoare logic in the rest of the talk, but I'm not going to go into a lot of details about rules. So separation logic builds on Hoare logic by basically incorporating into the assertions of the logic a notion of ownership of state. And the sort of poster child for this is the points to connective of separation logic, X points to V, which means not only that X is some memory location and it currently stores the value V, but also that the asserter of the piece of code that is asserting this in its precondition owns X, meaning it knows that while that code is executing, no other part of the program is going to be able to update or even read X at the same time. That's the basic idea of points to. We'll see an example of this in a second. The other major connective in the original separation logic is the separating conjunction or star connective, P star Q. And that means that P and Q hold, it's a form of conjunction, they both are true, but they describe ownership of disjoint state, okay? So for example, if you can assert that X points to V, star Y points to W, it means X points to V and separately Y points to W, right? So that means in particular that X and Y do not alias, they point to disjoint pieces of memory. So let's see how this gets used. Before I show you a concrete example, the way this gets used, especially in concurrent separation logic, is using this parallel composition rule. And the parallel composition rule basically says, verifying concurrent programs in general is hard, but you can make the proof of some concurrent composition, C1 parallel, composed concurrently with C2, very simple if they operate on disjoint state. Okay, and the way this is reflected in the rule is you have this, the precondition is P1 star P2. So that means P1, which is the precondition needed to execute C1, is some disjoint piece of state from P2, which is the precondition needed to execute C2. So if you know that they're operating on disjoint state, it means those concurrent threads will not interfere with each other's behavior at all. So you can verify them completely independently, each one ignoring the other, completely. So let's see an example of this. So suppose we want to verify some, in parallel, we have an update to X, we set X to be 3, we set Y to be 4. If we know that X and Y are distinct or not aliasing, which is implied by the precondition X points to 0 star Y points to 0, we know that X is not equal to Y, then we can just use the parallel composition rule to verify these completely independently and learn that in the end, X points to 3 and Y points to 4. So you see here, using that parallel composition where we just take the X into one proof and the Y in the other proof, and then you join them together at the end. And you don't have to reason about any interference between threads, which is sort of the thing that makes concurrency verification really hard. Okay, so that's all the good news. And by the way, you can sense that the good news versus the bad news in concurrent separation logic is connected to the good news versus the bad news in Rust, right? In Rust, we had this nice safe type system which prevented all these errors, but then we had to introduce unsafe code in order to implement certain things. So similarly, in CSL, you have this beautiful disjoint concurrency rule or parallel composition rule, which works in the case where the state is completely separate. But once you have concurrent manipulation of shared state, then things get more exciting. And there, CSL provides basically a method of invariance. Okay, so the way CSL supports reasoning about shared state is you establish some invariant on the state that's shared between multiple threads. So here, R is an invariant. It describes some shared resource that multiple threads want to manipulate. And then you have this rule here, which is the invariant opening rule. It says, if I want to verify PCQ and C wants to access that shared state that's described by the invariant R, then it can, okay, so we can get sort of temporary access to R by putting star R into the precondition in the premise. So long as we restore star R in the conclusion, in the postcondition of the premise. And so this gives you a way of sort of temporarily getting access to some shared resource as long as you put it back in a consistent state, okay? And a critical thing here is that C is atomic, okay? So meaning it takes only one step of execution. And this is important because, if C could take multiple steps of execution, you could break the, one thread could use this rule, break the invariant in the proof of the premise, right? Once it has P star R, it can do whatever it wants to mess up the invariant R in the middle of the proof, and then some other thread would be able to observe it. So it's very important here that C is atomic. It means that you're able to gain access to R for one instruction because you know that in the space of one instruction, no other thread could witness you messing up the state. So let me give you a simple example of this. Let me give you a simple example of how this works by appeal to that Mutex API that we saw before. So basically, so I'm going to show you an implementation, I'll show you a specification, and I'll explain how we verify it using the rules I've talked about so far. So in this mutex, it's represented very simply as a pointer to a single cell, which is storing either 0 for unlocked or 1 for locked, okay? The idea is that, so when you want to lock, you basically use an atomic compare and swap instruction to the lock, the mutex, atomically from 0 to 1, from unlocked to locked, okay? And it's important that it's atomic because you have multiple threads that might be trying to do it at the same time. And if you didn't do it atomically, then two threads might think they both acquired the lock when in fact only one should be allowed to do it at once, okay? So this is a very standard kind of approach to implementing a spin lock. Then the unlock function, once you have the lock, you know that you're the only one who can unlock it, so you just set it back to 0, okay? So here's a specification we can give for this in separation logic. The idea is and the specification is parametric in whatever resource invariant you might want to associate with the object that is protected by the lock. Okay, so P here is really describing some shared state that is protected by this mutex X. Okay, and so the spec is extremely simple. It says anyone is allowed to lock. Okay, you have trivial precondition true. If the lock succeeds, then you know that you have acquired the lock. So that means you have acquired this resource that is described by the assertion P. Okay, you've acquired ownership of P. Correspondingly, when you want to unlock, you have to release the ownership. You have to give it back to the mutex. And so you have to put that in your precondition. You have to provide P. And in the postcondition, you have true again. So that means the caller of unlock has to give up P, and in return, they get nothing. So just to see how this would actually get used, here's like two threads that are both trying to acquire the lock around a critical section, okay? And each of them, using the parallel composition rule, that's going to be, the precondition of this whole thing is going to be true star true, which is just true. So you can verify these completely independently, and each one will just acquire the lock, obtaining P. Then it can do its critical section where it does whatever it wants for as many steps as it wants, and as long as at the end it has restored P and before the call to unlock, okay? And so using this lock, you can verify concurrent threads completely independently as long as they are well synchronized. So let's now see how you actually would verify this. So because the mutex is shared state between threads, we need to put that state into an invariant. And the invariant is basically a two-state machine. Okay, so it's a disjunction between two possible states. I'm going to visualize it as a two-state machine where you can go back and forth between the two states. So in the unlocked state, the invariant owns the shared resource, okay? Because it's unlocked. It means no one has acquired the lock, so the mutex owns the shared resource. And so therefore you have X points to 0, you're in the unlocked state, and Separately, we also own P, the shared resource. In the locked state, we just have the fact that X points to one, because in the locked state, some thread has acquired the lock. So some thread has taken P and in fact may have temporarily broken P. Okay, so the invariant does not own it anymore. So now let's see how we use this to prove the lock method of the mutex. So this is the spec we want to prove, that if we go from true to P. The lock is basically, it's the spin loop, all right? Right, so it's spinning till the CAS succeeds. So I'm going to skip a few steps here. Basically, there's two interesting cases, the case where the CAS succeeds and the case where it fails. So in the case where it fails, it's not too interesting, right? In the case where it fails, that's the X points to one case, right? That's when the CAS will fail. And in that case, you don't do it. It's a no-op, basically. You just loop again, okay? So I'm going to go to the interesting case, which is the case where the lock, where the CAS succeeds, in other words, where X is currently pointing to zero. In that case, we apply the invariant rule. So with the invariant rule, we get to temporarily take ownership of the invariant into our precondition. This is where we had in that invariant rule P star R. So X points to zero star P in this case is the R that we move into our invariant. Okay. Now we own it. Okay. Now we have the resource we need in order to safely execute the CAS, because the CAS, you know, you're operating on this X, you need to have ownership of X. So we go from X points to zero to X points to one. That's just the basic rule for CAS. And notice we leave the P alone. Implicitly here, we were relying on something in separation logic known as the frame rule, which says that if you update only one piece of the state, then anything that's starred with that is unaffected, because that's talking about disjoint state. And now we have to restore the invariant, right? But now we're in the X points to one state. So we just have to restore, we just have to put the X points to one back into the invariant, because that satisfies the disjunction in the invariant. And we get to keep P and pass that back to the caller of the CAS. So hopefully that, you know, you sort of followed along roughly what's going on there. You apply the invariant rule, you do some state update, you restore, you apply the invariant rule, you gain access to the shared resource from the invariant, you do some state update, you restore the invariant, and then you're done. So this is sort of the recap of basic concurrent separation logic. We have the parallel composition rule for disjoint concurrency and the invariant rule for shared state concurrency. Let me move on to Iris now. So this is going beyond concurrent separation logic. Like, what is Iris motivated by? So basically the idea is that in Iris, invariants are not enough, okay? The concurrent separation logic invariants are not enough. Modern separation logics generalize this invariant mechanism in various ways to account for interesting uses, sort of more interesting forms of interference than you can capture with plain invariants. And there's basically two ways in which these kind of extensions, you know, what they look like. One is you want to be able to describe not only what is some invariant on state, but how state changes over time. For example, you might have a counter and you want to insist that it's monotonic, meaning the value of the counter only increases over time. You might also want to control which part of the program can make changes to the shared state, right? Not just anyone can update the shared state, but certain parties have permissions or tokens or capabilities or something that allows them to make a state change at a certain point during the program. And those two kind of extensions led to a huge amount of work. This is an old picture from Ilya Sergey. There's a lot more work that's gone on since then. This is a picture of concurrent separation logics. And, you know, basically one of the problems is in, as I mentioned before, these separation logics all provided sort of different, different rules for reasoning about these fancier forms of interference. And so these are some examples of some of these rules. Don't read them too carefully because I'm not going to talk about them. But the point is, these are complicated. They were all proven using different methods. It was not clear when we started work on this whether you could compose any of these rules with each other, you know, use them in one logic. We sort of felt there has to be a better way. So this is where Iris comes in. Iris is the basic idea of Iris is that all you really need are two things: one, invariants, and user-defined logical state. Okay, so this is the big new thing in Iris is this composition with user-defined logical state, which I will explain. And using just these two mechanisms, you can actually derive the rules of the most advanced extensions to ZSL on a unified framework. So I'm running a little short on time, so I'm gonna go a little more quickly through this just to give you the flavor of what this looks like. I'm gonna refer back to that ARC API that we talked about before, the reference atomic reference counting API. So here in this API, you have basically the arcs are wrappers around data with a reference count. Okay. And so when you want to clone the arc, right, you want to just bump up the reference count and then return a copy to the original object. Okay. So that's done using this fetch and add instruction, FAA, which is just an atomic increment to the count. Printing the value just prints the data. And dropping is the reverse of clone. So it decrements the reference count. And when the drop is the destructor of the arc. And when that reference count goes down to one or goes down to zero, then you can free the object because you know there's no more aliases. So the key thing here, which I want to focus on, more importantly than even showing you the whole details of the proof, is this specification. So so this is a specification for the arc that we can prove in Iris. And the key thing is that we have to introduce a new kind of predicate to represent the permission to access the shared data through X. You can think of arc of X here as like, this is how we're going to semantically model in Rust Belt the type, the arc type, okay, is using one of these permissions. So all of the operations on this type take arc of X as a precondition. You have to know that you have an arc in your hand. But then they do different things with it. So for example, the clone operation results in produces a new arc of Y for the resulting clone. Okay, and that arc of Y is separate from the original arc of X. So they're separated by this separating conjunction, arc of X star arc of Y. Similarly, you you see that when you drop an arc of X, you lose it in the post condition. Much like when we have the unlock, the spec for unlock, we lost the shared resource in the post condition. And so the key thing that you may notice here that's a little funny is, right, you know that the implementation of clone just copied X to Y, right? So Y here is actually equal to X. And yet in the post condition, we have a star between arc of X and arc of Y. Like, so they're pointing to the same thing, but nevertheless, these assertions are separated by a separating conjunction. So how can that make sense? Well, it makes sense because we now have this idea of logical state. So arc of X does not describe, unlike the points to connective in separation logic, arc of X does not describe physical ownership of the heap. Instead, it describes this logical ownership of the permission to access shared data through X. Okay. And so this brings us to this notion of ownership of logical state, which is really sort of the key concept or one of the biggest concepts in Iris. And so if you want to verify, I think in the interest of time, I'm going to go very quickly through this part. If you want to verify this arc example, then you introduce these notions of permissions, arc of X and count XN. Okay, and these are two logical predicates that describe logical state ownership. Arc of X I've already described, it's this permission to access the shared state. It's sort of one permission, a unit of permission. Count XN is an assertion that declares that currently there are exactly N arcs that have been generated for X, okay? N aliases. And so correspondingly with that notion of logical state, you have these two rules here that you see. One says that count of XN, if you have a count of XN, if you know that the current count is N, and you have an arc of X in your hand, well, then you have to know that N is greater than zero because you know there's at least one arc, you're holding it in your hand, right? The second rule says that if you know that the current count of X is N, then you can increment it. This is an update operation, which is why the arrow has three lines instead of two, pretty subtle point. You can actually update the current state going from X is N to X is N plus one, and at the same moment, you generate a new arc. Correspondingly, you can also go the reverse direction. That's why it's a double arrow. So you can also consume an arc and then go down from N plus one to N. Okay. And so in the interest of time, I'm actually not going to go through a lot of details about how this is, how we actually prove arc here. If you're interested, ask me afterwards. I'm happy to show you. The point is that using these two things, we can develop an arc invariant, which effectively ties the current physical state, which says that X points to this pair where n is the current physical count, to this logical count xn, and then by tying those together we can do a proof very similar to the one very similar in structure to the one we saw from UTEX, except this proof is actually going to allow us, I'm going to skip through this, I'm going to skip over this part, but basically as you see here, we apply the invariant rule, right? It's the same approach that you use in plain CSL, except now with this addition of this user-defined logical state, we are able to actually account for the kind of state change that happens in something like Arc. Sorry, I can't go through more details here, but I want to actually get to the last point in the talk very briefly. So there's lots of nice fancy animation. It's very good. Okay, so so you can. I'm happy to go over those slides a bit more later if people are interested. So the key thing that's missing from this story so far is at the end there, I introduced some logical predicates, arc and count. I gave you some axioms about them. I justified them sort of intuitively with some hand waving. How do we know any of that is sound? Like, how do we know that by introducing these axioms, which enabled that proof of arc, that we haven't made the logic inconsistent? So you could prove false, okay? And the basic idea in Iris is that we provide a very simple method of proving soundness of these kind of axioms. In fact, we have a word for this. We call, We have a way of proving these axioms. The basic idea is you define the logical state as some kind of resource algebra, which is modeled with a partial commutative monoid. This is a very standard approach to how you model separation logic to begin with. But the point is that you can define your own resource algebra, your own notion of resource with its own notion of composition. Iris then gives you two primitive proof rules. Okay, here they are on the slide, which allow you to relate the separating conjunction in the logic with your resource composition and give you a method for safely updating logical state over time. And then from those basic rules, you can derive much more complex ones, including the ones that I showed earlier, these ridiculously complicated rules, but also many other rules. So for example, in the Rust Belt project, we ended up developing a whole logic we call the lifetime logic, which is a logic for reasoning about the lifetimes of references in Rust. That was all done by, again, encoding some novel resource algebras, developing these kind of theories of manipulation of logical state. And then that allowed us to give a much higher level interpretation, semantic interpretation of Rust's reference types. So to sort of wrap up, Iris provides this very flexible logical foundation for, giving you the tools you need to build a high level semantic model of Rust types. And if you're interested in more of this, I urge you to check out some of our papers. We actually are developing much better tutorial material for Iris at the moment. And you can take a look at that here. And I just want to finish by just thanking all my collaborators, many, many, many collaborators on Iris and Rust Belt. With that, I'll conclude. Take questions. Thank you.
All right. So I think I'm live. Excellent. So I think we'll stay here.
So I should close video Ninja.
No, stay in here because there really is a lot of people in the gathering and we might be reaching a limit there.
Oh,
so
okay.
So we'll just stay here.
Stay here, but then there's going to be a delay for the questions. Or no, maybe.
Yeah, that's okay. But a couple of questions have come in already. So hopefully if you have any more questions, then you could either direct message Mike Sperber's staff. I should really mention who I am. But a few questions have already come in. Okay. So Stefan Weyer asked, well, how much work is it to verify a given API? I don't know if you can give a rough estimate.
By the way, should I move? Should I change my screen? I know that I'm now showing okay. Just show my slides again. Okay, fine. Yeah. Right. The question. Say the question again.
So how much work is verifying? I don't know what if there's a.
Oh, verifying a Rust API.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit of work. it depends. It depends on how subtle the safety is. So some of the libraries are very subtle. Some of them are more straightforward. So something like Vec, for example, is relatively straightforward. It's using some unsafe operations to sort of optimize, for optimization purposes, but not for functional correctness purposes. So in other words, you could implement something like Vec in safe Rust. It just would be inefficient, as opposed to something like Arc or Mutex, where the functionality is fundamentally going beyond what you could possibly implement in the safe fragment of the language, and then you really it is a lot more work. So I think this is a totally interesting is a very interesting question, and it's something we want to I know that my student Ralph Jung, who's been a leader of this project, really wants to work on is automating, or providing better automation for verifying safety of these unsafe APIs.
How much have you done the entire Rust standard library?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, we've done I don't know the exact number, but it's something like around 10 APIs, maybe a bit more at this point. We focused on the hardest ones we could. I mean, the hardest ones we could look at that were very commonly used and were not large pieces of code where there was lots of sort of. We focused on sort of things where there was a relatively small amount of code, but the reason it was safe was extremely complicated.
Okay.
So that was sort of to test, like, you know, is this the point was not that this is going to be that Rust Belt by itself is a realistic verification framework yet, because we don't have, you know, automation support. But the point was to explore the expressive power and make sure that the model was strong enough to account for all sorts of crazy stuff.
Okay. So is there any sort of, are there any methods available that have a lower barrier to entry available to people?
Not yet. I mean, there's increasingly a lot of interest in Rust verification, period. Mm-hmm. And there's in fact a Rust verification workshop that has been at ETAPS for at least since last year, maybe the year before. And we're working on some, we're actually a couple different tools for Rust verification. The focus of most of that work so far has been to ignore unsafe code and focus on just verifying safe Rust, because that's already interesting. We're of course, given our interest in Rust Belt, I mean, given our work on Rust Belt, we're very interested in actually being able to verify unsafe or APIs built from unsafe code more automatically as well. We have a paper that that's currently should be appearing in a conference sometime soon, I believe, on something called Rust Horn Belt, which is basically, so this Rust Horn is an automated verification approach to Rust that was developed a couple of years ago by Yusuke Matsushita and his collaborators, and basically their original work again ignored unsafe code. We've been developing a sort of semantic and a sort of extension or generalization of Rust Belt that allows you to that establishes that the kind of automatic verification of safe code that he was developing is safely compatible with APIs that use unsafe code. So there's a lot of work. There's a lot of action in this space, but there is nothing yet that people can really use to more feasibly verify APIs built from unsafe code.
Okay. As Emily mentioned, Derek mentioned bugs through the interaction between the extension libraries. Does Rust Belt model these library interactions?
Yeah, right. Good question. So Rust Belt does not model the library interactions explicitly. The whole idea of Rust Belt is you provide this one semantic model of Rust types, okay? And as long as you've proven independently, all the proofs are completely compositional. So as long as you verify that your API is safe according to the Rust Belt model, then you know any two APIs that you've developed that you've proven safe according to the Rust Belt model are safe or are safely composable. So you don't have to reason explicitly about any interaction. Now, of course, what that means is if you have two APIs that are fundamentally incompatible with each other, well, you're not going to be able to verify both of them safe according to Rust Belt. That's to be expected. Okay, you wouldn't be able to verify them safe against any version of Rust Belt because they're not safely composable, right? So, and what happens when people find that these such APIs are incompatible is they typically say, well, they have to decide which one they want to make, give support for, and which one they want to deprecate. The point is, yeah, Rust Belt does not require you to reason about interactions explicitly about interactions of different APIs.
We're running out of time, but maybe one last or complex of questions is, can you relate the, I mean, you asked about the logic that would be appropriate for use in this verification. Could you relate it to the linear logic that's underlying Rust's type system and maybe to temporal logic?
So I didn't quite understand the question. Could I relate it to linear logic?
The Rust type system is based on linear logic, right? Does that?
So I wouldn't say that, actually. I would say Rust type system is based more on separation logic. I mean, well, first of all, it's not based on anything. It's based on intuitions from these. And frankly, a lot of the intuitions underlying linear logic are very closely related to the intuitions underlying separation logic. To get it, you know, there are technically differences between these logics, and you know they're used for different things. I mean, separation logic has been much more heavily developed in this context of program logics, right? But the, I think you know for a first approximation, you can think about a lot of the things I've said as being you know relevant to your intuitions from linear logic. Temporal logic is a different story. I don't believe there's a clear connection between what Rust is doing and temporal logic, although the connection between temporal logic and separation or linear logic is a very interesting one that has, in my opinion, not been suitably explored.